Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hello and welcome to Movies vs. Capitalism, an anti-capitalist movie podcast. I'm Rivka Rivera.
And I am Frank Capello. And this is an exciting week for the two of us because next week, Rivka and I are traveling to Los Angeles, California, aka Hollywood, to attend the Ambie Awards, for which we are nominated for an award and the aforementioned Ambie for Best Entertainment Podcast.
Yeah.
So by this time next week, we will know one way or another whether or not we have won.
We will know if we're winners or if we're fucking losers.
Yeah. And if we lose, we have to stop the podcast. Those were the rules upon entry. So everyone better hope that we won. But we'll have an episode out next week, but we might not be able to record, you know, as close to the release date. We might record that one ahead of time. But Riff, we had a couple of things we wanted to talk about today. You know, there hasn't been a lot of major news, but there were a couple of news items that caught our eyes. Firstly, we want to talk about the South by Southwest Music Festival. This is a story you may have seen already, and I'm going to be pulling from a Guardian article written by Shad D'Souza. But if you haven't heard, over 90 plus musical artists have pulled out of the South by Southwest Music Festival in support of Palestine, citing the event's ties to the defense contractor RTX Corporation, formerly known as Raytheon, and its sponsorship by the U.S. Army.
Coming out the closet.
Coming out the closet of supporting music festivals? Like, this was the Army's coming out?
Yeah, I just feel like we've known there's like a lot of Army support. Just feels like, just really officially like, hey, we're here.
Oh, sure.
Love us.
Mm-hmm.
It was also not a great joke, maybe a bit of a dad joke. So
no, but I think that's a good point. I want to talk about that in a second. So this boycott was led by songwriter Ella Williams, a.k.a. Squirrel Flower, who published a statement on her Instagram on March 4th announcing her withdrawal from the festival. She wrote, quote, I am pulling out specifically because of the fact that South by Southwest is platforming defense contractors, including RTX, as well as the U.S. Army, a main sponsor of the festival. And then since then, yes, 90 plus artists have also pulled out of South by Southwest. But what you were, I know you were like making a dad joke, but I actually think that that is kind of the crux of what is happening here, is that A lot of these ruling class interests, like, you know, defense contractors, oil lobbies, whatever, are getting very, very comfortable being like, oh, we can also hang out in your cool public space or music festival too, right, guys? We're just a normal American business here for normal American things. Meanwhile, RTX is literally manufacturing the bombs that go over to Israel that have been killing Palestinians in Gaza. So, yeah, it's a pretty incredible show of solidarity from these musicians, I think.
It is, absolutely. And brave, because I don't think it can be highlighted enough that these are artists who are putting, to some extent, their own careers at risk. And yet the more people that come out and support, which is why solidarity is so important, the less the individual risk is, right? The more you're like, well, there are people who feel the same way and
mm-hmm.
they can't remove us all, and they really can't do without all of our labor.
Yeah, and especially, you know, coming from mostly gigging musicians, these are a lot of what you would call like undercard acts at music festivals. You know, like these aren't giant headliners. Right. These are all the musicians who, you know, to play a festival like South by Southwest is like, one, you know, a little bit of cash in your pocket, and two, also great exposure for you and your, you know, your musical career. So for gigging musicians who we know the life of a working class musician has become so much more difficult and tenuous over the last several decades because of the consolidation of the music industry and because of streaming and everything. So for them to say like, hey, we're going to forego this opportunity in order to stand in support and stand in solidarity with Palestine and with Gaza, that's huge. That's really putting your money where your mouth is.
We also wanted to talk about this other cool, I don't know what you call this. It's just a cool ass artist making some anti-capitalist statements that are really important. I don't think she's not a dame, but you know what? She should be. I don't know
After this, she should be.
After this, she should be. I don't know what makes a dame officially a dame, but Imelda Staunton, who plays the queen in The Crown, right? In one of the seasons.
Yeah, I'm not a Crown watcher, but I know that they change the cast every season, right? It's always a different actor playing the queen and the other character, whatever.
I am a Crown watcher, but part of the appeal of that show is that it's all one sort of like British drawl. Like it all feels like one dream. And so I know she's plays the queen, but I couldn't tell you when. But she wrote an opinion piece in the UK publication The Standard titled "Jobs in the Arts Are Now Just for the Privileged, and I've Had Enough of It." Love that. "And I've Had Enough of It."
Great headline.
Great headline. What she says is, every child deserves a chance. Talent doesn't discriminate, but opportunity does. There's no biological reason why a young person born in the poorest part of the country is any less capable, has any less potential than those born in the richest parts. But all too often, working class children are not provided the same access to the arts. The arts have been treated as a luxury rather than a necessity for far too long.
Yes.
Which, said out loud, feels like duh.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually quite radical to say out loud, because rarely do people point to it. We have this mythology in Hollywood for so long that, well, I guess like we do in the rest of our world, that if you work hard enough, the most talented, the most deserving will always get the job, and that obstacles such as, you know, where you're born or privilege, those are just tiny little things.
Or affording healthcare or housing.
Yeah. Or education or access to means of production to do these things is just minimal, because we can all have the opportunity to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And so I'm so happy that someone this successful, someone this talented themselves is saying it. It contrasts what I've heard before from actors and artists that I really respect and think are incredibly talented, but I've heard defend their positioning by kind of doubling down on, "I worked really hard to get here." Like, I'm sure you did, but
yeah, defending the meritocracy.
Exactly. The reality is, we know plenty of people work really hard. This is what happens with the Nepo baby thing, right? Why the Nepo babies get so annoyed, or as what's her face? Madam Webb.
Dakota Johnson.
Her defense is the best. She's just like, "It's just so boring. I'm just so bored of talking about it." And I'm like, I bet you are. But that's the Nepo baby defense, right? Is, well, yeah, it opens a door, but I have to work really hard to get here, by minimizing the door that it actually opens and the value of that door to begin with. So thank you, Imelda. I don't know. Imelda?
Yeah, no. Keep going.
Suddenly I've lost my privilege of a British accent. It's all over the place.
Yeah, and I think she was writing in regards to, you know, like arts programs and arts education for youth in the UK and like public education settings, and how important and vital that is, which I 100% completely agree. We've seen all of the studies that like children who have access to art, music, you know, painting, whatever, often live more healthy, sustainable, holistic life, whatever. But I think what you also touched on is extremely important, is the access to an arts career for working class people, which, just like I was saying with gigging musicians, has just become so much more difficult and tenuous than it was 30, 40 years ago, where, you know, like where there really was a class of working class, like tradesmen artists who could like afford to live in major cities where they're, you know, where they could create their art, but then also like were able to provide the means of subsistence for themselves. And that has just become so much more difficult, that like ceiling to access. And yeah, and that is what is so infuriating about the Nepo baby conversation, is that regardless of if, you know, if they just had a door opened for them and it was just a matter of talent or whatever, like still a lot of those Nepo babies didn't have to worry about fucking eating. They didn't have to worry about paying their rent. They didn't have to worry about so many other material factors that, I don't know, at least for me personally, used to get way in the way of me creating my art, either like from just like a logistical, practical level of like having the time and energy to do it. But then also like, you know, when I would go into auditions and think to myself, like getting this job would change my entire life, like materially change my entire life, then I am no longer able to go into that audition just like calm, cool, collected.
Chill.
Yeah, chill, spontaneous, ready to just listen and respond. It just like that shit fucking gets in your head. At least that's my experience. I know that's been an experience of a lot of at least actors that, you know, we know personally. So yeah, thank you, Imelda. Let's get her damehood. Her dame?
We've damed her, officially.
Officially. Look, the royal family isn't going to be around forever. Someone is going to need to step up and start handing out knighthoods and dameships.
Oh, we need to move on before I get into that conspiracy theory and reveal how much I have been online this week.
Oh, all the Kate Middleton stuff. I've kind of heard tangentially that there's something's afoot, it seems.
But one thing it's been brought to my attention recently by some friends is to remember that every time there's a multiple conspiracies afoot, there's probably some real world, non-conspiratorial capitalist bullshit going down. And we are being tempted towards distraction, of which I am a worthy one to be tempted with, but I'm aware.
Yeah. And I'm same right now, but instead, for me, my royal family is Boeing, the airplane manufacturer.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like I'm so deep down that rabbit hole. It's wild. Those motherfuckers just did not care about planes being able to fly. They just wanted to do stock buybacks and make their share prices better.
Terrifying.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Considering we're flying next week, let's just not go there.
All right. That's as good of a time as any to segue to our interview for today. But before we do, we just want to remind all of our listeners to subscribe to our brand new Patreon account, because we don't sell ads on this show and we rely on you and community support to keep the show going.
For just $5 a month on our Patreon, you can get access to new bonus episodes, our back catalog of bonus episodes, of which there are some really great ones, all really great ones, and you'll be directly supporting the show and the labor that goes into this show.
You could also leave us a tip in our tip jar, and you can find all of those links in the episode description in your podcast player or by going to mvcpod.com.
Or you can help us out for free by making sure to subscribe to this show and leave a rating and review for this show on your podcast player. Helps boost the algorithm. It gets the show in front of more people, which is really important, and we deeply appreciate it.
Also want to remind everyone that since we don't sell ads, we donate our ad space to progressive or leftist organizations that are looking for aligned spaces to promote the work they're doing.
So if you're part of an organization or a mutual aid group, a worker co-op, a political campaign, or some other org, we would love to promote your work here on our show. If you're interested in promoting your work on MVC, you can email us at moviesversuscapitalism@gmail.com. That's moviesvscapitalism@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back with our guest, Seth Simons, talking about Pig. Hey, everyone. We know that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is at the forefront of everyone's minds right now. So we wanted to take a moment and share some resources with our listeners on how you can help.
You can go to ceasefiretoday.com, which has a list of resources for actions to demand a ceasefire from our congresspeople. You can send them mass emails. You can sign a petition. You can find a protest. You can phone bank. They have a call script that will allow you to easily call all of your congresspeople. Again, that is ceasefiretoday.com.
And remember, the only way forward is addressing the root causes of violence, Israeli military occupation, and apartheid, and ending U.S. complicity in this oppression.
I know it feels like this crisis is really insurmountable right now, but the more we call our congresspeople, the more we show up at marches, the more we do anything and everything will help. So keep at it. If we all do this together, we can actually move the needle. Love you all. Solidarity. And stay safe.
Today we are joined by Seth Simons. Seth is a Brooklyn-based journalist and the writer of Humorism, a newsletter about labor, inequality, and extremism in comedy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Seth, truly, thank you so much for being here. I have to fanboy out a little bit right here at the top. I've been reading your writing for the last few years, and I'm truly such a huge fan. I forget how I first came across your writing, but as soon as I did, I was like, this guy is writing, in my opinion, some of the most important comedy critique, entertainment critique out there. So you write about this intersection that exists between the alt-right and sometimes outright fascists, the intersection between them and this sort of like anti-woke, anti-PC comedy scene, which is this really dangerous trend in comedy that has arisen over the past few years. And it's, like I said, it's very important and mostly not covered in a serious way. But I really love your writing because it appears that it's coming from a place of love. Like, it seems like you really love, you're a comedy fan first. So I'd love to learn more about your trajectory as someone who was a fan of comedy and now is writing critically about comedy.
Yeah, first of all, that's very flattering. Thank you. I appreciate that. Second of all, yeah, I mean, I'm interested in the intersection, as you say, between sort of right-wing movements and comedy, the industry, the community. I don't think sort of a lot of people know that the stand-up mostly that they see and consume comes from these ecosystems that are just sort of dominated by right-wingers. They don't think people know that the Proud Boys, for instance, were founded in the New York comedy scene. I don't think they know how many just sort of anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists and in some cases out and out fascists just are among the ranks of what we recognize today as stand-up comedy, the art form. So I'm interested sort of in unpacking how those ecosystems function, sort of the ways that more mainstream, polite, liberal comedians sort of funnel viewers down a winding path that puts them to the Joe Rogans of the world that then funnel them to sort of people like Alex Jones adjacent people. And I guess how I got there is just sort of a natural path as a freelancer. I started writing freelance journalism in like 2015 after quitting a startup job. And I knew a lot of people in and around TV, and I did the like puff piece journalism thing where I would write about who's ever new TV show is coming out, and you interview a few people involved in that, and you sort of mix that with a review of the thing that's obviously always glowing. And the longer I did that, the more I became tired of doing that and just sort of realized from talking to people that the environment that they were working in was awful, you know, in addition to being filled with right-wingers, comedy is also full of, you know, seedy little clubs that abuse labor and don't pay people and, you know, let abusers run wild. So, you know, my experience being a freelance journalist covering this world was the more people you talk to, the more horrible things you hear about, many of which aren't really covered because, well, the journalism's been dying for a long time, but for most of the time been dying, you know, the status quo in entertainment journalism has been fan-serving pieces, and I think sort of writing designed to facilitate parasocial relationships with artists and to sell tickets to things. So I sort of found my way from writing about labor abuses in sort of the improv scene to the darker and more dangerous stuff that I write about now, which is largely all of the, as I said earlier, anti-vaxxers and neo-Nazis and Nazi sympathizers in stand-up.
Yeah, I think it's amazing what you're doing, Seth. And I'm not as familiar as with your work, but becoming more familiar. And as I was looking it up, I'm like, God, it's pretty brave because people really do not like when you critique the shit they love. Of all the arts, I think there's such an anger when you critique comedy because there's something so personal. So I don't know. I mean, you probably have thought a lot about this, so I'd love to know your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
But something so connected personally to identity. We're constantly fighting on this show to say you can actually critique things and still love them. And it's important that your critique might shift your relationship and possibly shift your identity. And I understand how that's a scary endeavor, but ultimately it's for the best.
Yeah. To your point, I do think comedy is this weird, mysterious, magical thing where, as a sociologist I talked to for a piece last week phrased it, it's pleasure. Comedy gives you pleasure. And I think we form deep attachments to the people who give us pleasure. It's like sort of almost an erotic, romantic thing. And I think there's sort of a void of thought that is tempting when you laugh at something and it just clicks inside your head and, you know, it's physical, the relationship that you form with the thing that makes you laugh. And I do find that when I at least criticize comedians, you know, the reaction from their fans is really just kind of deranged often and brutal because, as you said, it's also really tied to identity. And what's confusing about it a lot of the time is, you know, I will criticize comedians' politics. I will, you know, criticize the substance of what they're saying and sort of try to ground it in an analysis of the real world. And what I'll hear from all of their fans, just hordes of them, is that comedy isn't about politics. Politics have nothing to do with it. I'm, you know, the crazy one for bringing politics into this thing. These people who are just trying to be funny.
Like, arguably one of the most political art forms, stand-up comedy.
I know. And always about people who are saying explicitly political things. I mean, the world I write about is like this little army of Rush Limbaughs and Tucker Carlsons and Alex Joneses who spend hours every week on camera, on mic, talking about politics. And at the same time, they are all convinced of their own apolitical nature, and their fans are too. And it just is like this mass gaslighting effect that I find to be fascinating and also very depressing, because I think comedy is sort of stunted as an art form because of the resistance to critical thought within it and sort of the critical vacuum that I think it's evolved in, where there really isn't much of a culture of comedy criticism or journalism, really.
It's also an industry and an art form of expression and opinion. You know, unlike writing a sketch or even for a TV show, stand-ups are getting up on stage and literally saying to you, here is my opinion, and here is why I think it's funny. And sometimes the rubber doesn't meet the road on that, like in a lot of what you write about.
It's really funny. I'm remembering in 2019, I wrote a piece about the owner of the Comedy Cellar who had said some really not nice or sound things about the 1619 Project. And I wrote a piece that, in addition to, I think, more substantive criticisms, called him dumb and made some generalizations about how stand-up is sort of run by gatekeepers like him who have very shallow understandings of race and things of that nature. And it made him really mad, and he summoned me onto his podcast to defend myself. I agreed in exchange for access to the club and for interviews and things of that nature. But I get there and sit down, and it's just like him and five other people who he, some of his like lackeys that he keeps around him at all times, berating me for daring to call someone I don't know dumb in a comedy club. They're telling me, you can't say this. Don't you know that you can't do this? It was, I'm telling you, it's just a completely different world in there. It's bizarre. And that's where all this is the Comedy Cellar. This is where so much of our culture has to go through before it gets to TV or wherever it is that the masses interact with these comedians. The whole art form is just forged in places like that. It's mind-boggling.
That's so wild. Let's get to the movie that we're here to talk about. Seth was so excited when you chose this movie. I don't even know if this is on the list that I gave to you.
No, I went off list. Off list for this one.
Great off list choice. You selected the 2021 film Pig, written and directed by Michael Sarnowski, based on a story by Vanessa Block and Michael Sarnowski, starring Nicolas Cage, Alex Wolff, Adam Arkin, and Brandy the Pig. Aw. You found Rivki found the pig actor's name? That's very sweet. This movie, we couldn't find the budget for this movie, but it has grossed somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.8 million worldwide. So if you've never seen this movie, although spoilers, we will be spoiling this movie, and this is one of those movies I would really recommend, you know, pausing this and going to watch the movie. It's really wonderful, especially if it's your first time watching it. But the synopsis is a truffle hunter, played by Nicolas Cage, who lives alone in the Oregon wilderness, must return to his past life in Portland in search of his beloved foraging pig after she is kidnapped.
Great synopsis. It's just, what a great premise. So this film, as Frank mentioned, was released in 2021 in July. And in case, like me, you've tried to erase some of those years from your mind, I'm going to remind you of what was going down. We were still very much in the heart of COVID-19 and the pandemic. In January, Biden is inaugurated as president. Following the January 6th insurrection, when a mob of pro-Trump demonstrators stormed the U.S. Capitol in an effort to stop lawmakers from certifying the results of the 2020 presidential election. And culturally, another big moment that year, it was the Britney Spears Free Britney movement had a big gain. She got her freedom back. So those were some really big things. So I think I'm going to leave it at that.
I think when everyone looks back on 2021, those will be the two cultural moments, is January 6th and Britney was freed.
Yeah.
Those are the most important things that happened that year.
Contrasts.
Big contrast. So Seth, the first thing we start the conversation with is we ask our guest, why did you choose this movie for us to watch on this podcast?
Absolutely. Well, one thing I've been interested in my work lately is the way the practice of art, of comedy, for instance, has been corrupted and, you know, taken over by capitalism, for, you know, lack of a more nuanced term, the way that people, artists, have to give up pieces of themselves in order to practice their art, the way they have to sell out sort of the compromises that they have to make to be able to work, just to be able to not even, you know, be rich and famous, but to pay their bills. And I don't think I appreciated this about Pig when I first watched it, but now that I've spent several more years writing about Saturday Night Live, for instance, and what it's like working at Saturday Night Live, it really strikes me how much the movie is about the commercial infrastructure of food and restaurants, and the way that infrastructure alienates the people who make food, which, you know, to me is the art in the movie, if we look at it as a movie about art, which I think I sort of do.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It alienates, you know, the chefs, the customers. It alienates restaurant workers from the experience of eating food with companions, you know, this very sort of human thing that I think bookends the movie, where at the beginning we have Robin, the main character, cooking and eating, I think it's a quiche or possibly a galette with his pig, who he makes some sautéed mushrooms, I think, and it's this sort of beautiful, loving thing. And then at the end, of course, there's this, we'll talk about it, I imagine, later, but this really beautiful scene, heartbreaking scene, where he cooks a meal for sort of the big bad of the film, and it's, again, this really beautiful, loving scene of him in a kitchen, making food, sitting down, everyone eating it. And then in between, we see all of the layers of the restaurant business that pull people away from that very simple thing of sitting down and eating. And it's fascinating to me, and I think a really moving examination of how that works. But I'm curious, what do you guys liked about it?
Yeah, yeah. No, Seth, I absolutely love all that. And I mean, I've talked about it on this podcast. I grew up in the restaurant industry. My dad was a restaurant owner in New Jersey, so this movie hits very, very close to home. Like, I've seen the way that the restaurant industry just absolutely chews up everybody from the ownership down to, you know, like the dishwasher. Like, it can be an extremely laborious, exploitative industry at its worst, and, you know, just a very, very tiring place to work at its best. But I love the framing around, because it's not just about the restaurant industry. You're right. It is about an artist, because Nicolas Cage's character of Rob is, when we meet him, he is this wounded artist. He's a chef, but he has chosen solitude over commodification. And that was kind of the big takeaway that I had on this go around was, yeah, mm-hmm. kind of applying all of these things that we've been talking about in this podcast and in how capitalism and the way that labor is exploited, the way it alienates people. So this movie is right in line with that. And it's such a beautiful story about, yeah. you know, why people choose to retreat, how trauma and pain and loss can inform, you know, your decisions in your artwork and whether or not you want to compromise your artwork or your vision or even commodify yourself. And there's a lot to unpack with the character of Rob, because we find out that he's lost his wife about a decade ago, right, when he decided to exit the restaurant scene. So it's kind of like, how much of this is grief? How much of this is he just didn't want to play the game anymore? But it's all packed in here. It's like, it's multi-layered. I don't think it's just one or the other. I think it's kind of mm-hmm. both and. Riv, I'm curious your experience, because this is your first time watching this, right?
It was. It was my first time watching it. I thought it was so stunning. I'm so grateful you chose this film. Yeah, I'm right with both of you on the themes of artistry, of this choice between commodification and isolation that, well, really like the false choice. I thought what was beautiful is like it shows how capitalism creates this false idea of choice. And I loved the themes of grief and how every character in this film is dealing with grief, but the grief is tied to this capitalism, and that at the end he goes back to retreating even after there's like an opportunity to potentially reconnect with humans. I feel like there was like a Hollywood option for this film, which would be that as Robin re-enters society and recognizes, oh, there's like respect for me as a chef again. You know, maybe I'm done grieving my wife, and this is the journey I needed to take to re-enter and start making money again. Like, there's a Hollywood version where he opens an amazing restaurant again and all is well. I thought that was really interesting, the contrast between what was the natural cycles of grief and then the cycles of grief within capitalism. And I thought the film did a beautiful job of defining those.
Yeah, because I felt like at the end, when he chooses basically to go back to the woods, he's not engaging with the commodified part of what his art and his passion is, but he is now working through the actual grief of losing his wife, because he's playing the tape at the end. But that, I think that distinction is so important, that he's like, I'm actually dealing with my human grief, but I still have recognized what this industry does to the thing that I love to do, which is fucking ruin it for myself.
Yeah, it really stood out to me this watch, the way that a lot of the main characters are just, you can see the way they've been selling off little pieces of themselves. I noticed how Amir, the broker or the supplier who, the Alex Wolff character who buys his truffles, in, you know, so many of his interactions with other restaurant workers as they go through Portland. He's putting on an affect. He's acting a little, and he's not very good at it. He's like being a fake version of himself to try to make his way in that world. It stood out to me that he, you know, he spends his life in this industry, you know, selling to restaurants, and he doesn't know how to cook. You know, the scene where he makes breakfast for Rob yeah. and he like sets off the fire alarm. And then, of course, you know, there's his dad who is just he has that scary line in like the middle where he tells Rob, you know, I control myself very well, but I don't think you know what I am. And of course, what he is a capitalist. He's, you know, the big boss hanging over it all, who is keeping his wife in a perpetual state of undeath because he can't deal with his own grief. And he won't work with his son because his son has to prove himself as a businessman before they can work together.
Fucking brutal. God, just such a brutal father figure in this movie.
And he's so good too, Adam Arkin.
Yeah.
Rob strikes me as sort of something I think about a lot writing about, you know, comedy and how to like just make a living. You have to try to get rich and famous, which is a horrible thing to try to have to become. And you have to, you know, be complicit in all these, you know, spaces that protect sex predators and neo-Nazis. And, you know, I think sometimes it's the only winning move not to play. But then if you don't play, you don't fix anything. You don't fight anything. I don't know what the answer is. But, you know, I see in Rob someone who has chosen you know, not to play, also for the reasons that you just discussed with his grief. But and it ruins him too. I mean, he lives alone in the wilderness. He has no friends other than, you know, his pig.
Seth, that's really interesting what you're saying, because I'm thinking about Rob's arc and the question you're posing of to play or not to play. And does Rob discover something in that journey? And I think he does. I think what he discovers is maybe this binary that capitalism poses, there are workarounds, and you still do need human relationships, like this relationship that he does build with Amir, that he cooks with him and he teaches him to cook in that final scene, which is so profound, and that this emotional power of food is a gift that he can give, and it's a gift he can give without, he finds a way to give it without commodifying it, but he can come out of isolation and still share the value of that. So maybe in some way that's like his revolutionary act, because there is, you see sometimes like the anti-capitalist fight can sometimes be, we'll just retreat. And that also serves the same purpose, to allow the system to perpetuate. That can't be the only option. That's so maybe he does kind of come up with this beautiful option at the end.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. And I think also, you know, the movie is about that journey through the underworld of art as a commodity back to art as a thing people do together. And something that is, I think, at the very heart of human experience, which gets lost a lot. I've been thinking about this, especially, you know, as journalism dies and arts journalism dies and all these, you know, critics and arts journalists get laid off, how, you know, I think what's going to be left is all of these corporations that exist to sell art to us and to cultivate our parasocial relationships with art and to our consumer relationships with art. And we'll lose sight of more simple and obvious fact that it's everything. Art is everything. It's the reason that we work and build our lives, and it's what we do with our families and our loved ones. And I really love that the movie gets us back to that sort of simple, him that cooking scene with Amir, and then him back in his cabin listening to the song that his wife played for him, which is beautiful, as he looks up into the light.
Also really quick on that final act, that is the moment where he is choosing connection over disconnection, and both with Amir, who he's been building this connection with, and there's a really beautiful throwaway line that I didn't notice my first watch, I saw this time, when he presents Amir's father the bottle of wine and he says, "Your son found this," which is a lie, but he's doing it because he's like, I'm trying to support this kid who I know has been getting a raw deal from this piece of shit dad his whole life. And then his choice to connect with the father, and it's such a beautiful construction in this screenplay that we learn that the only time Amir's father and mother were ever happy was the night after they came home from dinner at your restaurant. And the choice to essentially take down the big villain with love and with art and with expression and with care and with food, and that being like the plot device that defeats him, so brilliant and so beautiful. And it's a reminder that not usually in film is the villain defeated through, you know, some act of love other mm-hmm. than, you know, other than, you know, A Wrinkle in Time when everyone's, you know, surrounded someone being, we love you. But this is, it's a rare screenplay construction and one that is so effective in this film.
And it's the one that actually, because I did go down a Nick Cage rabbit hole.
Of course.
And have decided that I will die happy if I can work with Nick Cage. I'm sure everybody says that, but like, I really think we would have a great time.
Have you ever seen the Community episode where Abed takes a class on Nick Cage and loses his mind because he can't figure out if Nick Cage is a good actor or bad actor?
Nick Cage is not an actor. Nick Cage is an artiste. But I mean, it's pretty amazing that this is the filmmaker's first feature film. Michael and Vanessa wrote this story together. They'd done a short documentary together before, but really this was the first original scripted piece they'd written. I'd listened to an interview with Michael who describes having some success with this doc they did, was shortlisted for the Academy Awards. They got a manager, but really was given the assignment of like, you know, now's your chance, like write something. But his idea was, I'm going to write something that either can get made this path or I could shoot on my own. That just something that feels very smart, personal, that I would want to write. And, you know, the script gets to Nick Cage, who describes in an interview that I heard with him that, like you're saying, that plot line of cooking a meal to get what he wants at the end. You know, you could watch this as like a Liam Neeson Taken almost plot line, and then it totally subverts it because you're just like, this is kind of a thriller. What is he going to do to get this pig back? I love that. Yeah. And you're just like, he's got to do something wild. He's probably going to do something crazy violent. And then he cooks this meal, and it's so profound that was the moment that Nick Cage was like, I've never read a script like this. I'm doing this. I mean, could you imagine? And then apparently it was just like an amazing experience. And him talking about in this interview, he's like talking, saying the most profound, beautiful, moving stuff about art. And then his cuckoo clock goes off. Literally, I said, wow, I want to be in that room with that cuckoo clock so bad.
I mean, wow, killer first feature. That's amazing. Yeah. Great work, Michael, if you're listening. Yeah, let's talk about the scene in the middle, which I said earlier, I think is my favorite scene, where where Rob and Amir, in their quest to find more information about the pig's whereabouts, end up visiting Finway. Or is it Finway or Finway's, which is like the new bougie restaurant in Portland.
Yeah, and it's one of these insanely pretentious restaurants where the food is deconstructed scallops or something in a little glass bulb with smoke.
Like sea foam and pine smoke or some shit.
You know, and it's just a little plate with two tiny little morsels of food on it that, you know, Robin reaches over and squishes one of them with his thumb. And he brings the chef over and sits down. And, you know, it's a guy who worked for him before in his, you know, big restaurant that when he was a famous chef all those years ago, and fired after 2 months because he overcooked the pasta. Yeah. And, you know, the guy has... He runs this hugely popular restaurant now that he clearly, his heart is not in. And Robin pulls it out of him that his heart is not in it. And it's, I don't want to spoil it.
Oh, we're in spoiler territory.
No, it's just this totally heartbreaking scene where he tells this guy that no one cares about you. None of it's real. You're not showing yourself to these people. This is all fake. You're a phony. And, you know, it's one of those things where you expect the guy to argue and for it to be, you know, more of a conflict than it is. But the guy just breaks down, too, just like Adam Arkin breaks down later.
He also comes at the guy from a place of, again, a place of love. He's not just saying, like, this concept is shitty, this is stupid. He's saying, what is it that you said that you wanted to do 10 years ago? Like, what was, because you were passionate about that. And it was like opening an English pub.
Yeah, and the guy, he just like slowly cracks under Rob's questioning. It's really a wonderful performance.
Yeah, the actor David Nell, just one scene, absolutely just comes in and kills it for that scene.
Yeah, I mean, you got me thinking about the grief running throughout it all. And I do think now that Robin has, you know, there's so much of the movie is him zeroing in on, you know, the sense of loss or grief in other people and pulling out that sense of what's missing from them and, you know, getting them to buckle under the weight of it. And it's really phenomenal. I just love that scene because it, you know, again, bringing it back to my thing that I write about, so much comedy out there is, you know, you watch stand-up, you see improv, so much of it is just people going up and saying things that they obviously don't care about that have, you know, nothing to do with anything. It's all fake. Of course, this is going to be the case in any art form, but I've been doing this for, you know, I think 8-9 years now, enough time to watch people start out and then just gradually realize what it takes to commodify themselves and then go and commodify themselves. And then, you know, you see it happen once you look everywhere, you see it everywhere. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to realize that that's what it is. That's what it takes, again, just to be able to pay your bills a lot of the time, is to turn yourself into a brand. And you see all these machines that train people to do that and that punish them if they don't. And I love that scene because it just, in just a few minutes, it blows it all up.
Yeah, I think there's something so beautiful in his relationship with Amir that, as you're saying this, he could be so much harsher, like teach him that lesson in such a harsher way from the top. And while he's definitely not, well, he's definitely rugged and raw, and I think like
stinky,
growls and stinky and bloody and like growls at Amir, like, you know, he never does that shaming thing that you would imagine Amir's father has done. I'm thinking now about just how much Robin Feld's character can teach us also about how we can talk to people about revolutionary ideas and how we can also talk to people about, you know, it's hard when you're railing against something and when something feels so unjust, but Robin finds this beautiful way of not removing himself from the truth of that, but leading with love, mm-hmm. which is why everyone melts under his spell in some ways. And this also idea of that, like, the food is at the heart of it, that food is nourishment, food is sustenance, and he can get at that.
You've reminded me of something else that stood out to me this watch, which is how Amir doesn't respect him until he finds out who he is. He just sort of blows him off. He, you know, treats him like an asshole when the pig gets stolen, and Rob goes and sits down in Amir's car. Amir's like, you know, this isn't my problem, right? And it's only later when he finds out that he's, you know, Robin Feld, one, this big name, and two, the guy who gave that meaningful experience to his parents, that he starts treating him with respect and like a human, which I think, again, speaks to the sort of alienating effects of capitalism, in that, you know, here's this guy who is supplying you with the stuff that got you rich. He's part of this system that you're a part of. You know, he's not as rich as you. He's not driving the fancy car, but he's going out and getting the raw materials that your livelihood depends upon. But you don't see him. You don't see him as a real person until, you know, he turns out to have been established as someone, an owner. It's really beautiful how elegant that comes across, I think.
No, Amir he's like the perfect foil for Rob in this character. Rob, who at this point, and when we meet him, is putting nothing on, has stripped away all of the bullshit from his life. Sure, he's still, you know, his walls are up because he's defensive, but he's not putting anything on, as opposed to Amir, who we see a scene of him pumping himself up in the mirror, saying the things that he's going to say to people out in the real world, because this antagonistic, aggro, alpha, you know, I'm the best salesman, I'm the best business guy, you know, hustle bro, grind set persona is just not who he is at all. And I think, yeah, I mean, maybe there's a version where Rob is like shitting on him for that. But I think smartly, Sarnowski knew, like, oh, we don't need to do that. His dad is, we're going to learn that his dad has been doing this to him his whole life. So we don't also need Rob to be shitting on Amir.
Yeah. And I think we also get the sense that maybe Rob was that kind of person when he was a chef, you know, 10-15 years ago. And, you know, it's interesting. I wonder if there's sort of an implied tension between him and his, you know, dead wife, if he was, you know, over consumed with work, if he was one of those husbands. Is in her tape at the end, it's like his birthday, I believe. She's making him this tape on his birthday, and she says that he has some event or something where he's going to be angry to have to deal with all these people, and she's going to have to get drunk to deal with him. And I wonder, you know, how much of his grief about her loss is also wrapped up in grief maybe about the way he treated her, or, you know, whether he was absent.
Yeah.
I feel like we see hints of that in the way he now treats Amir, and the way he treats what I guess is one of his former employees who now owns the space and has a bakery there. And, you know, there's some sort of distance between them that we don't fully come to appreciate, or that we appreciate but don't fully come to understand, rather.
Yeah, I love that. I thought it was great that he was still imperfect. I mean, he wasn't perfect by any means. And I agree with you. I think he's grieving that he can't get back what was taken from him. even in trying to isolate himself and pull himself out of society, that it's still about relating and how we relate to one another and how we care for one another. And that's what capitalism is really stealing from him. And the grief in that is really profound. It's also profound that this film came out in 2021 in this moment when we're all coming out of our, still in our isolation, and how we needed this tale, this very specific kind of thing to remind us, at least to remind me, that we can't grieve alone. Like, grief is not something you can do in isolation. And I'm sure he was trying to do it for so long. He needed a mirror in that sense. And even with Brandy the pig, while animals are so incredible, I do believe it's something that humans have to do with other humans.
Yeah.
This is a movie about, I think, someone who has isolated themselves and then is learning to reconnect with the world and reconnect with their art as well. Seth, you brought up the really interesting idea in this movie about, you know, the value of Robin's name getting bandied about at these different moments in the film to sort of get things done, to get the reservation, to get the ingredients that are going to be a pain in the ass to get. And it's this concept of like reputational capital, which I don't know if we've ever really talked about on this show, but, you know, which is essentially the currency attached to someone's name. And that is something that is played out time and time again in this movie, whether it's either, you know, Robin's value as this person who used to be this famous chef, or whether it's Amir's father who carries this sort of reputational capital of being, you know, I don't know, the scariest produce guy in the greater Portland metro area. that's what I'm imagining. I'm imagining it's like, who's your produce guy? Oh, fuck it.
Yeah.
Amir's dad? Oh boy, oh God, careful with that guy. So I found that story device of the reputational capital playing through being something like very part and parcel to kind of this bigger theme of, you know, what it means to commodify one's self or one's art.
Yeah, you know, he goes up to that other chef at the beginning who runs the fight clubs, and the guy's like, your name used to mean something in this town, but doesn't anymore. it sets the whole stage for everything that follows.
Yeah, and it was interesting how they contrast that name moment with his, like, he's physically made to be huge, Robin Feld. Like, he's this huge looming physical presence, but without his name, no one seems to really be affected by his presence. Yeah. And then suddenly, that literally, in the fight club, shifts everything. So no one's, like, really worried or afraid. And even though he's, like, very scary and big and blood dripping from his face, he has to write that name down, which was beautiful. I'm curious your thoughts on that fight club scene.
That's part of the movie that mystifies me. You know, I see yeah. it sort of as part of the little dance the movie's playing with the audience where, you know, you kind of are like, is this a John Wick thing that's about to happen? Are we going into a John Wick type experience here? And then it subverts that and turns out to be something much more tender and heartfelt. It goes to show the way that people who work in the restaurant industry, their stress.
I think I'm right there with you. I actually had a buddy who works in the restaurant industry say to me at one point that this was a real thing, that there are underground boxing clubs where essentially sous chefs can pay to beat up like a CDC, a chef de cuisine, just because, yeah. I don't know if this is true, and I don't fully trust my friend, and I tried to do some digging into this to find out if there was any actual reporting on this. I couldn't find anything, but for the sake of the film, it's another brilliant construction. It's the opportunity for Robin to reveal who he is in a way that that materially demonstrates the value of what his name still holds. And yeah, it's just what a cool fucking idea. And you know what? And it makes sense. It makes sense that sous chefs would want to pay to beat up a CDC
yeah.
somewhere, just based on how abusive the restaurant industry can be, especially for like people, you know, back of house folks who are actually working on the line, and especially in like very high end places where the CDCs can be, you know, true sociopaths.
And I think that's a very old thing, in that, you know, in the Middle Ages, there would be these carnival days where the peasants would get treated like kings and the kings would be treated like peasants. But, you know, that goes back.
Yeah, it's exactly yeah. that. Another one of my favorite things about this movie, this is a 90 minute long film.
Yes.
Which
so good.
You do not see many of these days. And this is a full story, top to tails, 90 minutes, in and out. And I love yeah. it for that, for the economy of storytelling.
Yeah, because they know what they're doing. They know what story they want to tell. They're telling it. And they're not making us sit through scenes where they're figuring it out.
I also like the Fight Club scene because it then does the second round of, you know, kind of putting all of these wounds on Rob's face. And they make the choice in the movie that he carries every single wound with him from the first moment when he's assaulted during the pig kidnapping all the way through the end. And I think, you know, it's like a pretty on the nose metaphor for, you know, he's carrying all of his trauma, all of his wounds around with him. But it's effective, you know. It definitely, you know, Amir at some point would have been like, yo, bro, go, like, I have a bathroom. Like, go wash your face, please. Like, we're going into this fancy restaurant. You look like you just got mugged.
Yeah, I think it also goes to show the singular focus of him on just getting his pig back, too.
Yes.
And the way, you know, everyone in this world is so obsessed with pretense, with, you know, the food, with the restaurant, with the bulb, with the smoke coming out from under it. And all these layers of abstraction that, you know, again, separate us from other people, from the people and the animals in some cases that we live with and do everything with. And he's on his way to the thing. He doesn't care about any of that.
Also the commentary and kind of humor that he can get away with walking around like that if Amir's like, oh, he's Buddhist or oh, he's this. You know, you imagine that it's clear that under different circumstances, if it wasn't a white man who's Nick Cage walking around with Amir, who can say, no, he's with me, that it would be a whole different circumstance. But in Portland, they're like, we'll let this white guy get away with it. Like, he's not a threat. Maybe it's some performance art. Maybe it's something cool we don't understand, you know?
A really beautiful moment I hadn't appreciated before where Amir is thinking about his mother, who his father has kept alive because he can't deal with the thought of her dying, I guess. I mean, before I saw it as purely just a gross thing, now I see it as grieving, just like everyone else in this movie is grieving and is unable to deal with their grief. And Amir recognizes that as a profoundly twisted thing and a profoundly ungenerous thing to the dead. I thought that was a really beautiful moment that I hadn't clicked for me before.
All right, well, Seth, this is the point in the episode where we like to give out awards for this movie. We have three of them. It's like our version of the Oscars. Our first award is Best Politics. Goes to the character with the best politics in the movie.
Well, I feel like it's probably got to be Rob or the child just sitting playing with his little instrument.
is
uncorrupted.
Yeah. Yes. We've often talked about on this podcast about how children and animals have perfect politics every
it's
time.
It's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Brandy the pig did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob probably just because he's completely over the commodified food scene, and you know, I don't really want to, you know, not dealing with his grief is not necessarily political, so I don't want to like say that that's it's bad politics to grieve poorly. So yeah, probably Rob. Riv, is there anyone else?
Yeah, I have a contender.
Oh, okay.
The woman who is in the foraging community who has the truffles, who they first go to, and she doesn't really want to deal with them. And then as soon as he's like, they stole my truffle pig, she jumps into action. It's like great solidarity. She's like, doesn't want to deal with Amir, but she's like, I get it. You don't fuck with a forager's truffle pig. And she jumps in and gets him connected and gets him started on his journey, with which without her, he'd be nowhere, because she's the first one to sort of like give him the info he needs. And she's willing to be like, fuck the capitalists who I may be betraying. Like, I'm going to help my dude out.
That's a good one. Yeah. She's like, you're coming from my community, and like, I'm going to protect my community. Good politics.
Yeah. And she plays it really. The actress is great. It's a small scene, but she's fierce and she's wonderful.
Yeah. I love when Cage says, they took my pig. And I think her response is, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Our next award is Worst Politics. Goes to the character with the worst politics in the movie.
I mean, I think it's got to be Darius. Amir's dad.
Pig stealing daddy? Capitalist daddy? Yeah.
Yeah. Not only is he, you know, like just this rank capitalist, like I'm the biggest shark in this fucking pond kind of guy, but he's also the type of businessman who will do illegal things like pay to have your kid, your pig kidnapped, which is terrible. You know what? That if you're going to hurt an animal, the worst possible politics.
Yeah, truly. Mm-hmm. Fuck that guy.
All right, and our last award is Best Supporting Character / Spinoff. Goes to your favorite supporting character and maybe a spinoff that you would want to see them in.
I'd be down to spend more time with Alex Wolff, Amir.
Yeah.
Good character, endlessly watchable actor, clearly got some interesting things going on, learned some lessons about how to live his life in this movie. So hopefully you'll take those in the next movie and deal with even slightly, you know, even more complex problems that teach him new ways to live his life and expose deeper flaws and, you know, that he hadn't recognized before because he hadn't had the perspective. So I think he's perfectly set up for a sequel. Or the kid.
I just wanted to grab a persimmon after that monologue from Nick Cage. I said, can Nick Cage and I please go eat a persimmon together?
Riv, is your answer just like more Nick Cage?
Absolutely, more Nick Cage. No, I want to know more about that foraging community. I really wanted something more about the world of these foragers and this community who's like really creating the prized food that then gets brought down to Portland. And I want to know more about like the rivalries and contrasts between those two worlds.
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect of it.
I would go with the, you know, it's the lazy answer, but I would take more of the underground Portland restaurant fight club scene. I would take sort of like the more John Wick tech style story about, yeah, like these evil produce guys, mob bosses, these underground fight clubs, the League of Bus Boys. I want to see the whole back of the back of house restaurant scene, but like it's also crime related at the same time. I think there's historically been a lot of overlap between the restaurant industry and the organized crime industry. So
yeah,
I could go even deeper on that shit anytime.
Yeah, I think that'd be good for AMC, AMC Plus, maybe even Paramount. Yeah.
Yes. Well, this has been such a wonderful conversation about this film. Thank you again for bringing this to our attention.
And thank you.
I'm excited for hopefully more people watch it if they haven't already. Before we wrap up, we love to discuss with our guests how they strive in their lives to practice their values, be them any kind of anti-capitalism or whatever values you want to discuss.
For me, is in my journalism work, my goal is to help people be ethical consumers of comedy and of pop culture, which, I see part of that is exposing how deeply unethical the industry is. And also, I think just to give people a deeper understanding of how artists are navigating that world, and not just artists, but also people who, you know, work in the back of house at comedy clubs. You know, there is this whole support ecosystem in what is essentially half, you know, entertainment, half restaurants. And that's, you know, why I report on labor issues in the industry. And it's also, I think, one of the main things I've been doing recently that I haven't published on as much as I should is sending around public records requests to, one, colleges that bring in comedians to do shows there, and two, publicly owned venues where all of their contracts and all of their event settlements are public records. And so you can get a sense of how much money people in this industry are actually making, which is a lot more than I think a lot of comedians recognize. You know, Colin Jost is making $100,000 for shows at colleges. You know, people like Matt Rife are coming away from theaters with $200,000 in a night. There's a lot of money out there. And it's not really going to most of the people who make the industry run, which is, I think, kind of mind-boggling to see, especially, you know, as the whole industry collapses, like every other industry, and club wages have stagnated for decades, you know, it's still possible for people at a certain tier to effectively just turn on a money spigot by going on tour. And my hope is that, you know, I've been writing for years about how comedians should unionize, which is obviously everyone should, but I think there's tremendous potential in comedy, which is full of people who have enormous platforms and large fan bases that worship them. If sort of there can be a more focused labor movement in this industry the way there is, you know, among actors and directors and in Hollywood proper, I think it would be hugely influential while improving comedians, you know, working conditions. But yeah, that's sort of what I'm after in my work. And, you know, as a consumer, I try to spend my comedy show dollars on DIY venues and, you know, sort of the few nonprofits and, you know, small non-clubs that exist rather than the more rapacious and almost exclusively Zionist-run comedy clubs in New York City. Mm. So those are the sort of two ways I try to practice what I preach.
Those are great answers. And where can our audience find you and your writing if they want to learn more about all this stuff and where they should be spending their comedy dollars?
You can find my writing at humorism.xyz. Yeah, that's my newsletter. It's mostly free. Occasionally, I send out subscriber-only editions to people who pay $6 a month, but for the most part, it's unpaywalled.
Awesome. And we'll make sure to link to it in the episode description. Seth, this was such a great conversation. It was so nice meeting you, and thank you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. So go to
the lobby. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok. And if you want to support the show and get access to our Patreon episodes, you can go to mvcpod.com to subscribe.
For next week's movie, we'll be watching the 1998 film, The Truman Show.
Thank you all.
Bye.